ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When you're young, you get plenty of advice from older people about what you should go for, what you're good at, and what you're not so good at. But perhaps the best advice you can get is to simply not listen to these free character assessments from mostly well-meaning people. When Rhonda Wilson was in her last years of school, she received some career advice that told her that she might, quote, at best, make a good mother. That was about it. And yesterday, Rhonda is a mum, and she's also a professor of nursing at RMIT with a PhD. And she's just been elected president of the Australian College of Mental Health Nurses. So Rhonda's found herself a nice little sideline, apart from being a mum, as it turns out. But it's not like Rhonda shook her fist at the sky as a young person and said, I'll show you, you bastards. Rhonda simply found herself pursuing the things that interested her. And this led her from being a trainee nurse into psychiatric nursing and thinking about how to help people in rural and Aboriginal communities in Australia. Hello, Rhonda.
Hi, Richard.
You're a country girl. Tell me which part of rural New South Wales you grew up in.
I grew up on Annawan country, the New England Tablelands, a tiny little community called Wongwabinda, halfway between Gyra and Ebor, not too far away from Armidale. I still think of it in miles, 50 miles from Armidale, and right next door to the Cathedral Rock National Park. So very beautiful landscape there and beautiful country.
What was the farm like?
It was a sheep farm, a grazing farm. It was my grandfather's property, and we were living on the property, on a cottage on the property, surrounded by sheep and just that rural country lifestyle.
Does that mean you have sheep for friends when you're a kid in a bit of a property?
I did have sheep for friends. I had a lot of potty lambs, and I suppose one of the things that we really loved to do as a family was pick up all the potty lambs or the orphaned lambs that were around the property. And I remember one year we probably had about 32 potty lambs. It was a huge number. And so I always got a lot of joy out of caring for those lambs. Didn't like it so much when they got sent off for sale. In the country, of course, often you eat your own meat. And so I wasn't very amenable to eating the potty lambs that I'd raised.
Did you come up with names for these potty lambs?
Oh, they all had names. Every single one of them had names. It was ridiculous. And one year we were starting to run short on names, and so we started to go through Disney characters to get sufficient names. And I suppose from that batch, I still remember this little lamb. Its name was Donald Duck. So I don't know if it had a real identity crisis, but he was Donald Duck.
People who live on farms, people who are on the farm, they find something to occupy themselves from dawn till bedtime. Was your mum like that?
Oh, yes. I think it was an incredibly busy lifestyle for my mother. My father drove machinery like bulldozers and tractors on other properties, contracting that work for agricultural work in that way. So that left my mother at home caring for children, and not like today. You know, we had electricity, and as I said, we did have the drop toilet for some time. Didn't have hot water on though, so I think that was tough to raise children and long hours by herself. So her way of keeping busy, in addition to all of those chores that need to be done, is craft. And so she was an incredible craftswoman, and making lots and lots of things, lots of fibre in particular was her flavour. And with all the wool on the sheep on that particular property, she did a lot of spinning at that time, which was really a lot of fun.
Sounds like her ambitions ran to something larger than that from time to time, than knitting and yarning here and there. Like she was passionate about mud bricks as well.
Yes, there was the mud bricks episode. And so our little school, my mum would help out in that school a lot. And one of the things she'd help out with was craft. The other thing was music lessons and singing. But this particular year, she decided that the craft project for the school would be to build a mud hut. What
wow.
could be more delightful?
So you excavated the mud and made bricks? Did you fire them or bake them in the sun or something
baked
as well?
Them in the sun, just bake them in the sun, adobe bricks.
And what did you made a hut with all these bricks?
A little hut with chimney, and then once it was all finished with its bark roof, we had a stretcher bed in it and, you know, all the kinds of bits and pieces that you might need to have a fairly meagre existence in a small hut. Was great cubby house for the schoolyard.
What were you like as a school kid? How academically involved were you?
Well, I spent a lot of time kept in at school. Kept in at lunchtime. I remember lots of times being kept in because I just didn't get maths.
I wasn't for being naughty then.
No, it wasn't for being naughty. No, it was for academic failure, really. Although by the time I did graduate, I would like to point out, because it's a very proud personal fact, that I did graduate as co-ducks of Wongrabinda Primary School. But I will point out there was only one other person in my class. So,
still, both the top and the bottom of the school.
That's right. I prefer to look at the glass half full.
That's right, indeed. Quite rightly so. So then you got a scholarship to go to a posh girls' school. What was that transition like for you, Rhonda?
That was completely different to a small country school. I suppose as a boarder in that school, a lot of kids came from rural backgrounds. I think that it was particularly challenging to feel like you fit in, particularly with the level of affluence, I suppose, that many of those students would have come with. It was an interesting transition. And it was difficult moving from the country into the city. Armidale isn't a large town, but it is known as a city because of its two cathedrals.
And compared to the little town you'd grown up in.
Well, it wasn't a town that I grew up in. It was just the land.
Farm. Mm. How did you go as a boarder?
I didn't like it very much, I have to say. I found it quite confronting to share a dormitory with, probably eight other girls or something.
Who are all dedicated to destroying each other's personalities.
Yeah, pretty much. So I wasn't particularly comfortable and I didn't enjoy that, but I did recognise the privilege I had to go to that school. So it was a really interesting period, I suppose, of my life.
So after a year boarding at that school, where did you go to live?
Thankfully, I was able to go and live with my grandmother while the family made arrangements over the next year or so ahead to move into town as well and make that the home base. But I got to live with my grandmother for about a year, I think, and that was a very treasured time as well.
Yeah. How did you get on with her?
We were extraordinarily close. She was an incredible woman.
How so?
I think that she was very guarded about her early life history. And she didn't want to dwell on that. She wouldn't share a great deal about it. There was always a lot of curiosity about that, but clearly she'd had an upbringing that was quite impoverished, I think. And so she became very resourceful, and she was somebody who was propelled to find better and more secure ways for herself in the future and to forge that forward for everybody who came after her.
Right, so she wanted that for you then, in other
words. She definitely wanted that for me and her other grandchildren.
Sounds like she wasn't relentless about that with you or cruel with it. She was just the opposite then, was she?
She was very warm with that and she'd encourage it in all kinds of ways. Things like, for example, she saved up her pension money to send me to grooming and deportment classes, June Daly Watkins.
Really? Is that one of those things where you have to learn to walk while you're balancing a Bible on your head or something like that?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, right. You did.
Right. And upright posture and all that sort of thing. Shoulders back, girls, that sort of thing.
Shoulders back. And you know which fork and what cutlery to use and etiquette. And
no eating with your hands.
No, definitely not. And I guess this morning as I was thinking about having a chat with you today, I was remembering both my boarding school experience and her. And one of the things was that at boarding school you had to have a serviette ring to hold your linen serviette in, of course. And so she went out and got me a serviette ring and had my name engraved in it so that I would be proper and so that I would pass. And
is that the phrase she used?
Yeah, it was.
So you would pass.
So you would pass.
How would she spend time with you? What would you do together, you two?
We'd play a lot of Scrabble and play a lot of canasta. And, you know, so when you play long games like that, you spend a lot of time connected and talking. And so these periods of playing those games gave us a lot of connection and the ability to kind of think about and talk about what was meaningful and in the news and public discourse at that time, really.
I think playing Scrabble is a fine way to develop a kid's brain too, isn't it?
You
learn to make words and you have to understand their meaning. You learn those words that are going to get you the high scores, which have got a lot of Q's and Z's in them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all of that.
She was a master of that somehow. I don't know how, but she was. I think she had an Oxford Dictionary for breakfast every morning, I think. I'm not sure.
So she's doing all this lovely thing. She's making you feel really lovely and encouraging your growth as a human being, talking about passing and all of that, and being a bit guarded about her own background. What did you later learn? What did you piece together about her real background after long afterwards?
I think that she really wanted to make a way forward for people in her family. So she maintained a guardedness. She changed parts of her identity in order to make a way forward. She changed her name. We didn't know what her birth name was, and I'm sure many people in the family still don't know. So it's a real curiosity, and it remains a real curiosity to flesh out her history that she was so guarded about.
And what was the truth of it that you found?
It's still a work in progress. It's still a work in progress. Yeah. But I think she probably had to do a lot of very challenging things.
What can you tell me about her background?
She would tell us about her experiences of being a chiropodist and a masseuse in places like King's Cross in Sydney, which we just accepted as kids. And she did have a self-taught knowledge around, particularly around, I don't know, caring for people, caring for injuries. So she did have a little bit of knowledge about that.
Like nursing, you mean?
Yeah. In fact, I even have a dictionary that was hers. That is a dictionary for nurses. I think that she's probably picked it up in an op shop sometime. You know, it's very old. I can't remember how old it is, but it is well before she met my grandfather and had their own family.
Yeah, what did she say about her parents?
Her mother had very challenging background as well, I think. I think she spent some time in, I think the centre, we'd call it a centre these days, but it wasn't called that then. I think it was kind of a home for hopeless women or something like that.
Fallen women or something
fallen
like that.
Fallen women. Right, it might have been, yeah, that kind of thing. She had a child and her former husband had died, so she was a widow. So she had one daughter and anyway, eventually she met my great-grandfather as best I can piece it together. And he was a blacksmith that had come from Tumbarumba area, and his family, about the time that the family house burnt down, he seems to have had to moved on. And some family members didn't need to move on and some did, but he seems to have moved north and so managed to find some work on the railway and worked his way up to as far as Taree by the time and Coffs Harbour by the time he's met my great-grandmother.
And when she said to you, you'll pass, what do you think she meant by that?
I think that she meant that you need to pass as a white person and you need to pass as somebody who is acceptable to society. And so she would reinforce that with things like making sure that she would give us gifts, for example, or give me gifts of things like table napery, serviettes and embroidered cloths and lace cloths, and so that I'd be able to host tea parties for people in society when I was an adult.
But still, she said to you, you'll pass. Is that her way of her trying to tell you that you had Aboriginal blood?
Maybe, or maybe not tell me that. For her, it was very important that we would be acceptable and able to participate in society.
And present this front of white respectability. What do you think of all that now, looking back on that, Rhonda, about your grandmother? And I have to imagine a fair bit of mental suffering with all of that, trying to
I have to
like
imagine that.
That
as well. And particularly for her and siblings, her siblings. But what I make of it now is what an extraordinary feminist to try and make meaning and try and take forward opportunities to uplift particularly her granddaughters, as I recall it. So I think what an extraordinary feminist. You know, she must have been very much, well, I think she had some schooling. I don't think she had very much. Now, here is somebody who's a real self-starter with education to be able to play Scrabble to the level she did and to read to the extraordinary level she did. She was she loved to read. I think that's extraordinary.
So having discovered that your great-grandfather was a Wiradjuri man, did that make sense to you
from
in a funny
Wiradjuri
sort of way?
Country.
From Wiradjuri country. Does that make sense to you in a way?
It certainly, it does make sense to me. I think it doesn't make sense to everybody in the family, but it certainly makes sense to me. And I think that it is something that I have always been aware of. I think my earliest memories on that sheep property were having that time that's connected to the nature around you. And my mother was a real singer. She would like to sing and play guitar. So that musicality, I suppose, was there to some extent. But one of my greatest joys was to be out in the backyard and to be singing to country, really.
Would your grandmother offer clues about this and the way she talked to you?
I think so.
Cultural clues?
I think so. There was one story that I think resonates. Now, whether it was a story she was passing or not, it's difficult to, you can't definitively say anymore. But there is a Wiradjuri story about a crow and about some young girls who, during a particularly dry period, I gather, so perhaps drought, I don't know. And my retelling of this story is not, that cultural elders, Wiradjuri cultural elders will have, a much clearer version of this story. But as best that I can piece together as somebody relatively new to that is that these young women had left the community, had been sent off to go and gather water, to find water. So it's quite treacherous to go off alone from community. There are dangers. And, if you fall short or if you fall into danger, then, of course, crows are there and would they pick your bones kind of thing. So so here are these young women going off to make improvements for community's life by trying to find some water to and so I draw a lot of meaning from this story now with my own work, I suppose. But my grandmother would again shake her crooked finger at any crow she heard and say, "You're not coming for me yet. You're not coming for me yet," to warn it off. So whether, that it has a great deal of resonance, I think, when you start to piece together some of the parts of her history.
So while you're going to this posh girls' school, you're getting this whole other education from your grandmother on the side, and then you come to the end of the education and you have this meeting with a vocational careers person at the school. I think I might have paraphrased that right at the start. Can you remember what that person actually told you about what you'd be good at, what you should attempt and what you shouldn't attempt, please, Rhonda?
Well, basically she just said to me I'd make a great mother. That's where my skills would lie. That's where my expertise, you know, where my skills were.
Did she phrase it like oh, you're good to be just a mother? Did you?
That was the inference.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty obnoxious.
Yeah.
Am I just putting the standards of today on yesterday? I don't know, but you'd be just a mum, is what she said.
Yeah, pretty much. Right. That's it.
Did you believe her at the time?
Yes, I did. Absolutely. I had no reason not to.
I think it's very easy when you're that age to believe what older people tell you about yourself, the free character assessments you get.
Yeah, that's right.
I think of all the ones I had when I was that age, they were all wrong too from older people. Oh, no, you're like that. And you look back and you go, what, really? I mean, deciding what you like when you're that age is really all a bit mad. So what did you do when you left school then, Rhonda, with that helpful advice?
That helpful advice was year 10. And so I thought, well, I'll leave school now then. And I had a part-time job on Thursday nights and Saturday mornings at my local Kmart selling shoes.
Sorry, you left school on that advice?
I left school on that advice.
And went to work in Kmart?
It reinforced, yeah. I just thought, oh, great, I'll go work in Kmart, and I sold shoes. And once I left school, I moved on to Coles and worked as a checkout operator at Coles.
Where did you go from there, Rhonda, in your brilliant career?
In my brilliant career? I think I did some hospitality. I did some receptionist kind of work at a solicitor's office. I did a whole bunch of things. But one of the jobs I landed was becoming the general library assistant at the University of New England.
And what was your role there?
I was the photocopy girl for most of that time. So,
do you need a person to photocopy? I remember I did my own photocopying back in those days at uni, but they needed someone to do the photocopying?
Well, they needed somebody to look after all the bank of photocopiers. I mean, you had to put your 5 cents in, and invariably that went wrong somewhere, or the paper got, you know, caught up, and somebody has to go out and fix it for the poor student that went to university.
So. Oh, God, I'd never want to go back to those days with photocopiers and all that again. I mean, yeah, like photocopying half of a book, which is quite illegal, actually. But
it is illegal, actually.
You did it all the time as well. And were you envious of the students around you at the time?
I know I felt quite important. Here I am. I've got a position in a library, and I felt really important, actually. And more than that, I got to photocopy the articles for the external students. So there were a lot of particularly psychology external students at UNE. And so I found their papers really fascinating. So you're photocopying the same article all day, ready to get packaged off to the external students. And occasionally you just got to have a look at one. Yeah, have a read. Fascinating.
So that's what got you interested in that world, just reading the articles you were photocopying.
Yeah, well, it is a pretty boring task, photocopying, so you've got to do something to keep yourself entertained.
Well, I just can't help but reflect that you're obviously a really nice and a curious person, because I can remember there were some pretty serious petty tyrants around those photocopy machines back in the day. That's their domain, and if you intrude upon it, but instead you're reading these articles. And how are they affecting you, reading those articles?
I was fascinated with the information about human behaviour that I was reading. I didn't necessarily understand it very well, but it was enough to really fascinate me. So when it was very busy periods and a paper came across and I thought, oh, that's a little bit interesting, but didn't have time to read it, then I probably make an extra copy here and there, and you can imagine how illegal that was at 5 cents a page.
Even today, that sounds ruinous.
It does. It was. It was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
But I think having worked for UNE, and I have been exonerated by vice chancellors at the university in the past, and I think they do feel that they ended up getting their 5 cents worth out of me. So
what triggered the jump from being the photocopying assistant librarian at the university to going to nursing school for you, Rhonda?
Well, it was at that time that a good friend was killed in a car accident, and he was in his third year of hospital-based nurse training. His name was Phil Roberts. And I guess at that age, I just thought, you know what? The world is going to be missing out on a nurse here. Who is going to step up? it's irrational, but young person, grief, all of those things.
There's a hole in the world after someone dies young, isn't there?
There is. And you try and make meaning of it. And I thought, well, somebody's going to have to step up. Perhaps that could be me. And so an opportunity came up to enrol so I applied for trainee enrolled nursing at Tamworth Base Hospital, an hour and 10 minutes down the road, which seemed like the world away. And I got accepted, and that started my nursing journey in June 1987.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you made the leap. You started training as a nurse at Tamworth Base Hospital. What do you remember of your first time on the wards at Tamworth, Rhonda?
Oh, my goodness. I remember my first bed bath very well.
Yes, why?
So what happened was we called them Tudor sisters in those days, and we were split up into two groups to have the Tudor sister demonstrate how to do a bed bath on a person. So I was in the group that was allocated to a four-bed male ward, and so the curtains were drawn and the Tudor sister is going through the whole process, and I suppose there must be six of us or more crowded around this poor man who's about to, you know, be bathed in bed under the observation of all these trainee enrolled nurses. So I guess the air was getting a bit thin and you're standing still for a long period of time, and I fainted.
Was it just being on your feet for too long, or can the sight of an old man's naked body do that to an impressionable young woman?
I'd like to leave that very ambiguous, and, because the other men in the ward certainly wanted to know what he had that was so impressive, I can tell you. So that was the beginning of my nursing career.
It was uphill from there, though. Once you became a nurse, what was it that you enjoyed or even loved about the work?
I guess I loved the routine of it. I loved being able to care for people, obviously, and to realise that what I could do, even as a trainee enrolled nurse, what I could do could help people to be more comfortable when they were uncomfortable or when they were in pain. So I could assist them with decreasing their pain and promoting their comfort. And I think that is one of the things that is key to nursing, is absolutely fundamental to nursing, is helping people in that we promote comfort so that they can get about all the things that they need to do and want to do in have meaning in their lives.
I think as a patient you can be in with a very capable doctor, you can be slightly in awe of their expertise. But I think for a kind nurse, a dedicated nurse, there's something even above awe you feel for that kindness. There's a kind of great moral courage, I think, in a really good nurse. Mm. What do you think about all that?
Well, I love that you use the word kind, because we often use words like kind and compassion and care as though they're soft, as though, you know, they're somehow how weak, they're nice.
Oh, no, they're strong things.
But these are extraordinary strengths. And these are skills that need expertise that needs to be learned and honed over time, because not every nurse turns up to work every day and feels as though they have the agency and the strength to be kind and compassionate, and yet they do, because that is the expertise. So the expertise that nurses bring to caring for people with physical or mental health challenges is absolutely extraordinary, and it will last the whole shift. You don't get a break from it if you're in the acute sector, for example. So learning to do that is very, very difficult indeed.
I think people have, by and large, only a finite amount of courage. Even people with the most enormous amount of courage only have a finite, that's just what I've heard from war veterans, they can do this dangerous thing again, and one day they find the store of it is run out. Is it like that with compassion too, to be honest? Is there like only a finite amount of compassion you can call upon as a nurse in the job? And do you find days where you find that the glass is empty there?
Oh, I love that question as a mental health nurse, because I don't think it is finite. I think that it can continue to be topped up, but I don't think that is easy. So the way we do that in mental health nursing is through clinical supervision, we call it. And so it is through a reflective practice of working with what's been and how you went through that particular process or what your experience was, and then drawing forward what you've learnt and bringing that agency to the new experience. So it is a continual looking back, finding ways to refresh and draw forward that agency and strength to move on to the next challenge. So it is this continual process of working backwards and forwards and undergoing, making sure that you're working with your own mental health needs through counselling, through clinical supervision. So we do have models of actually being able to do that. And that's what particularly mental health nursing is very focused on, is bringing that agency every single time. So when you encounter a kind, compassionate, caring nurse all the time, that's actually what they're doing. They're bringing an awful lot to that experience.
How about humour? Because as a person who spent like 10 years in the hanging around comedians, being in the comedy world, comedians have the comedy they perform for audiences, but when they're amongst themselves, they've got some super black humour they wouldn't dare share with an audience. And the point is to, I don't know, it's a kind of a valve release or something, and you're actually making a joke about what a dreadful mind you've got that can come up with that sort of thing. A nurse is the same? No, I'm not asking you for examples here because it's not broadcastable. But do nurses have a similar store of super black humour they only dare share with each other?
I think that is fair to say that they do.
And is that necessary? Because it must be necessary in some ways.
There are some things you see and experience that you can only see as extraordinarily funny. And I think you do have to be able to have a laugh about things. You do have to be able to make light of difficult situations.
In ways that civilians might not necessarily understand.
Exactly. Exactly. I suppose, all right, here's an example. I don't know a nurse who can't talk about bodily functions and enjoy a lovely meal simultaneously.
They ought to give you hazard pay for that, I think, as nurses think. So as a nurse, was there a moment when you thought, I can take this further, I can do something more with that?
Yes, there certainly was. I can't think of another word to describe it at the moment, but I suppose there was kind of an epiphany moment, if you like. And it was back in that training enrolled nurse days in the orthopaedic ward at Tamworth Base Hospital, as it was known then. And I had become aware prior to that there were these nurses called doctors of nursing, particularly in the US. And I picked up the phone one day and we had a particular procedure about how we would say what our designation was and our last name. And so I picked up the phone and I said I was 10 Schaefer at that point in time. And I just felt, you know, one day I'm going to say, hello, it's doctor, somebody speaking. So not
like medical doctor, but as in doctor, PhD doctor.
Yep, nursing doctor.
So that's a bit like the flash of insight you got about beginning nursing in the first place.
Yep.
And did you attend to that thought? You must have, I suppose. You reflected on that. And how did you decide to act on that then, Rhonda?
Quietly, I didn't tell people about it. It was something that I just continued to draw forward and lean into in my own consciousness, I think. And I really didn't talk to people about that aspiration because that was far too lofty to even utter out loud.
And as I've said several times, you hadn't had the greatest amount of career encouragement in the past, had you? So you just get that to yourself. But then you enrolled at uni.
I did, because I loved what I was doing as a trainee enrolled nurse, and I knew I had to become a registered nurse. I just knew from that moment onwards that I needed to take steps towards that end goal of becoming a doctor in nursing one day. So I just, so I kept enrolling and moved into, back to Armidale to commence my studies at Armidale College of Advanced Education, which is now University of New England.
And so as, an undergraduate, you met your husband, Glenn. Tell me how you met Glenn.
I met Glenn in a rock pool. In a rock pool, which is a reasonable place to find Glenn even today. In a rock pool.
What, in a national park?
In a national park, yeah.
How idyllic.
Yes, it was idyllic.
Was he just there waiting for you outside the rock pool or what?
Yeah, it appears that way. No, we
Did
were.
Did he say, hi, Rhonda?
There was a,
I've been waiting for you.
I've been waiting for you all my life. No, no, it wasn't quite like that. We were, a whole bunch of university friends and college friends and local friends were, we decided we were all going to go for a bushwalk and a picnic and just outside of Armidale. I think it was the Blue Hole. And I was aware that this person, Glenn, wasn't going to be fit to go on the bushwalk.
Why was that?
Well, the first thing I noticed was that he had a scar on his leg and hip. And as, you know, somebody who'd freshly come from training enrolled nursing and the orthopaedic ward, I recognised that scar and I thought, you know, oh, he's had a hip replacement. And so I thought, oh, he's not going to be able to do the bushwalk. So I'll stay back with him, because, you know, nurses do that, and keep him company. And so my introductory line to him was really, and so you've had a hip replacement. I'd completely missed the fact that he was missing a whole right arm and, you know, had experienced a dreadful car accident, and in that car accident had lost his arm. So we do look back on that moment and laugh now that there's my big pickup line. So you've had a hip replacement. He hadn't had a hip replacement. He'd had a lot of other surgeries, but not a hip replacement.
Yeah, but being a nurse, you probably wouldn't have been as weird about it as a civilian would, right?
Perhaps this is just one of the I don't know, this is what I do, I suppose. I look for the people who aren't being included or can't be for whatever reason, and I think, oh, how can we gather everybody together? How can it be fair for everyone?
And how long did it take you to realise there might be more serious than that?
Yeah, I think over the next 6 months or so, it evolved into something more than a clinical relationship into more of a romantic one. So
I've got a photo of you in front of me and Glenn, and this is from the time you got together, and you're wearing this green dress, and he's got a matching bow tie. Is that of the same fabric?
It is. We went to a ball, and Glenn was resident at Robb College at the University of New England, and they're quite famous for their balls, and that year I was lucky enough to have an invitation to attend the ball with him, so I thought, oh, I better make a dress. So as somebody who makes things, I thought, I'll make my dress. So I got some lovely green shot taffeta and I made a dress and then made him a matching bow tie and cummerbund as well, all by hand to go to the Robb ball. So it is a treasured photo, really. I quite like that photo and the dress. I think that was all right too.
How did you then move into mental health nursing, Rhonda?
Mm. Well, I suppose we moved to Townsville after Glenn finished his honours at UNE, and he was offered a PhD scholarship at James Cook Uni, so I had to relocate my nursing studies. And one of the things that James Cook Uni had was they had a real strength in mental health nursing lecturers there. So you could probably consider the course at that time was almost a major in mental health nursing.
But what were your preconceptions about being on a psychiatric ward initially?
Well, I think I was probably scared because I knew nothing about mental health. And I think that, you know, that's fairly common to, if you don't know about any phenomena, the first reaction is to be a bit cautious and perhaps even fearful. And so I was a bit worried about doing the mental health course because I didn't know what it would entail of me, what it would require of me. And I think that I was a little bit concerned about some of the things that I didn't know about my family. I knew enough to know that there were some family members, as there are in all families, I would hasten to say, there was talk of breakdown sometimes, and I didn't know what a breakdown was, and I'm not sure I still do.
And the Great Australian Silence that used to descend on that.
The Great Australian Silence.
Yeah, on the We Don't Talk About That.
No, we don't.
Right.
And in country Australia, you know, you certainly, in the era that I was growing up, you don't talk about things like that, and you do keep children shielded from it.
So what happened when you got the textbook on this course?
It was read from front to back and scribbled all through, and I just devoured the whole thing.
Really? What was so gripping about it?
Again, I was drawn to human experience and behaviours that were explained, and I was just fascinated. So it's kind of a clear thread between my library assistant days when I was doing the photocopying right through to that chapter or that textbook, and just discovering the diversity of humanity was such an eye-opener for me.
So you'd already known that we're all made of, you know, crooked timber, us humans. Mm. You'd already known that. But seeing it described, the brokenness described like that, that was a real eye-opener for you. And how about the language of that, just having the language to describe and diagnose and talk about these things? Was that a thing for you as well?
Yeah, to begin to have a vocabulary where there is very little vocabulary, particularly for somebody who is naive with, you know, mental health conditions. And I think this is a huge challenge for you know, young people who don't necessarily have a vocabulary for the experiences that they might be having themselves.
I've heard discussions about this issue in the past, about talking about mental health in a way that's not just medical or psychological, but also spiritual as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely spiritual as well. I mean, we are spiritual beings. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about that in terms of a religion. I'm talking about our connection with each other, with the world we live in, and the ways we make meaning of all of these things. And all of us make meaning of our everyday lives. To some extent, that is spirituality. And that connection we have between each other, with the world around us, it all needs to be taken into account in a holistic manner to assist us to understand mental health and well-being and to strive for that.
So you did your undergraduate, you did your master's, then you did your PhD. Mm. That's why you're a doctor and now professor, Rhonda.
You
Wilson.
Made that sound really fast.
Yeah, I did. I'm sure it was just like that too. It's all done like that, yeah. What was the area of your PhD? What were you focusing in on with that?
Mm. So my PhD was looking at young rural people's mental health and how we could help young people get the help they needed earlier for mental health conditions.
Using digital technology to make that happen?
No. Any mechanism. I wanted to understand more about how we could get people in earlier, because I knew that the longer that people are unwell, the more difficult it is to, you know, have a positive mental health outcome for those people. So, and I did know that in rural settings, young people tend to have a longer duration of untreated mental illness, significantly so, and I wanted to find a way to bring that back down so that it was comparable with urban populations at least.
But is that mainly about distance issues, or are there cultural issues there as well?
Both. There were lots of different factors there, and it's also a resourcing issue as well. And I suppose that was one of the key things that came out of that PhD, was that people said, well, we understand actually that economically it wouldn't be viable to have a mental health setting in every small country town. The nation probably can't afford that, okay? But surely there should be something that should be available in something online or digital. And I wasn't expecting that as a finding.
What, that pragmatism, you mean?
Yeah. Mm. But given that that was one of the findings, that, I guess, led to my next mission to figure out, well, okay, as somebody who comes from country Australia, rural Australia, perhaps I better be at the forefront of developing digital resources to assist people with their mental health conditions, so that those, you know, urban developers don't get it all wrong for rural people, that their interests are considered. So I thought I've got something to bring to that. And so that's where I land at the moment.
The other work you've been doing is an idea developed to help mental health patients with anxiety. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, well, there are lots of ideas, but I think that maybe the interesting one is some of the work we're doing around some immersive relaxation techniques to support people with dysregulation or stress in various contexts. And so,
this could be people like on the autism spectrum, you mean? That kind of
could
thing?
Be, yeah. could be a whole range of any situation that is stressful, I suppose. And I'm doing this work in particular with my PhD student and colleague, Oliver Higgins, who's both a mental health nurse and a computing scientist. So that's a win-win in my books when I have a digital health laboratory. But we're doing this work and we've built a proof of concept around an immersive relaxation experience to assist with dysregulation to help people with stress. So we have got these pop-up room that we can have an immersive experience in. So we can actually have a tailored experience so that we can work with the person to figure out things that are most likely to assist them to relax.
So what would be some of the things that might be in that room to help that person relax?
So we might, for example, talk with community and gather some stories and turn those stories into a simulation. So, for example, the story might be something as simple as going for a walk through a rainforest. And so we develop a scenario where you have wraparound vision, you can hear features from the rainforest. We'll have people falling to sleep now, and I would call that a win. But
I was thinking, can I get one of these in my house? I don't know.
Hear birds, hear waterfalls, hear all the things that you would hear if you went for a walk through the forest. And you hear them from different directions, not just one speaker. So we might have sound, we might have vision, but we might also have scent, and we might have temperature, we might have breeze, all integrated into our system. And then we also have the technology to collect biometric information without anybody wearing anything. But we've got sensors built in where we can detect moments where people start to relax more, so that we can actually draw forward the relaxation experience to the critical moment in the installation, so that we can know when somebody's relaxed, calmer, and perhaps that assists them. As I said earlier, this is what nurses do. We try and promote comfort. We want to get people to the point of comfort so that they can then re-engage and make logical decisions about ways forward.
We were talking right at the beginning about how you eventually discovered one of the reasons why your grandmother, who you'd spent that time with, was quite cagey about her background, was that there's Wiradjuri heritage in your family. How does that work into your day-to-day consciousness of the work you do and your practice as a nursing expert, professional, academic?
So I see myself as a mental health nursing scientist. And there aren't many of those in Australia. Not every university has one. Not every nursing school has one. And so that's problematic in itself. We do know that in Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are disproportionately within mental health services and within prisons in large numbers. We know that the dashboard for Close the Gap is demonstrating that some of the outcomes are really getting worse for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That resonates very deeply with me. And as somebody now with extraordinary privilege in developing mental health nursing science, it's also a cultural responsibility, I think, to be producing evidence to support the social emotional well-being and mental health outcomes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I think that is something that I can contribute strongly to. And so that resonates across all of my work as a priority. I'm talking about priority populations, and I prioritise the way I do that. It's even changed the research methods that that we select for many of our research investigations. We use Indigenous research methods to investigate health problems for First Nations populations. And we do that not just in Australia but internationally, because internationally similar problems exist. So as someone who is developing expertise in that area, then I think that it makes a strong contribution. Anything is going to be helpful for both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia and also First Nations people globally.
Just finally, was there a day when you were really conscious of the fact that the phone rang and you picked it up and you said, Dr. Rhonda Wilson here? Like, because that was the thing, wasn't it? Was there a day where that actually happened?
Yeah, I made sure there was a day that that actually happened. Once that PhD was conferred, I did do that a couple of times. Usually I answer the phone, hello, it's Rhonda speaking. But I did do that after my PhD. Hello, it's Dr. Wilson speaking. And it did, you know, I completed that task. The new task is on to developing resources that improve the mental health outcomes of people.
Yes, I know, but I'm just saying you're entitled to a little bit of a slight moment of satisfaction, surely, Rhonda. Yeah. I think as a result of that.
I did derive a little bit of satisfaction from those few calls, yep.
Rhonda, it's been such a joy to speak with you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Ah, kids. 1 minute you're cuddling them in your arms, and the next, they've morphed into a teenager. And now suddenly you've got to figure out how to parent in a whole new way. I'm Bec Sparrow, and on this season of Parental as Anything, we're talking teens. How to navigate the hormones, the dramas, and all of the many changes while staying mostly sane. From what to do if your teen is hassling someone for nudes.
She was like, more of what? And eventually he just went, nude pic.
I was horrified that my boy could do this.
To how to handle the pressure to let them drink.
You have kids who push buttons, and if a kid wants to drink, you know what? They're going to find a way.
We look at dealing with big teenage emotions.
She was extremely emotional to the point of saying things like, no one likes me, I hate school.
And how to break through to your teen when they've shut you out.
It's difficult because I don't feel like I know how to connect with him.
Plus, there's so much more. So join me, Bec Sparrow, for this season of Parental as Anything Teens. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you listen.